The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. Max here. I hope you're well. It's 20 to 1 in the afternoon, and we finished recording about 20 minutes ago. I'm just sat down in a hipster cafe in East London waiting for hummus and roasted vegetable panini. And the news has just broken from Newcastle United that Rafa Benitez is going to leave at the end of his contract on the 30th of June 2019. It's like they wait until we finish recording and we've all left, and then they break this news. Newcastle say, "We've worked hard to extend Rafa's contract over a significant period of time. It's not been and will not be possible to reach an agreement with Rafa and his representatives." Not a huge surprise. The timing either. So this is not discussed on the podcast, but England v Cameroon and all that shithousery is. Enjoy that, and we'll talk about Rafa on the next pod on Wednesday. Bye. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Cameroonian meltdown. England through to the quarterfinals in a game dominated by a bewildered referee, some lengthy accurate VAR, and an opposition who got increasingly angry about the whole thing. Elsewhere in one of the games of the tournament, France edge out Brazil in extra time, while Germany see off Nigeria and Norway penalty their way past the disappointing Matildas. England's under-21 men's side is still the best team at the Euros, despite losing both matches. In the Copa America, Argentina squeeze past Qatar and Alexis Sanchez scores another goal, while in AFCON, Uganda win for the first time at the competition for 40 years. We'll do all that, engage in some mindless transfer gossip, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm tremendously well, thank you very much.
Back for a second pod, Tim Stillman. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
That's total pleasure. Selected again. Were you excited when you got the call?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm feeling like a veteran now. I'm coming for Barry's chair next time, I think.
Well, that's big talk. Jonathan Wilson, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
In your Ultra Sling 3.
Yep.
I've just informed you there is an Ultra Sling 4. Many people got in touch after the pod. How do you feel that you're in inferior sling equipment?
Well, I've looked up the Ultra Sling 4, and it appears to have an extra strap. So there's a strap that on mine, there's a strap that goes sort of across my chest and over my left shoulder. Mm-hmm. And this has the Ultra Sling 4 has an extra strap that goes underneath the left arm and round to join to the right elbow.
It's kind of like a policeman's gun holster.
Yeah, it says it prevents neck pain, and I have to say I have had a little bit of neck stiffness, although I've been doing physio for that. So perhaps I have lost out.
Would you say the days of the Ultra Sling 3 are over? Is this a disappointing time for Ultra Sling 3 wearers?
Well, yeah, I had no complaints at all until I became aware less than 5 minutes ago of the existence of Ultra Sling 4. Sometimes you buy a nice new jumper, mm-hmm. but you just wear the old baggy one because it feels right.
Absolutely.
And I think that's how I feel now with the Ultra Sling 3.
Live from France, Susie Rack. How are you doing, Susie?
Yeah, good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Now, last time we spoke to you, we were in the middle of a dual carriageway. Are you somewhere safer this time?
Not particularly. I'm in Lille train station waiting for a delayed train to Rennes.
Okay, how long have we got until the train departs?
Well, that's a good question. It's supposed to depart around now. It's delayed at least half an hour, so all are good.
Okay, excellent news. Well, if you have to get on the train, just announce it and we'll get the sound effects. It'll be exciting for us. All right, then. England 3, Cameroon 0, in a game that, for me, was kind of half completely tremendous and half ridiculous. Susie, you were there. How was it from within the ground?
Just very, very surreal. I mean, I've watched Cameroon play twice. In the group stage against Netherlands and Canada, and they were brilliant. I had a lot of respect for their manager. I thought it was great in the press conferences afterwards. They played really well. I think the fact that at the end of that, there was the Cameroonian press were kind of very, very critical of the performance, given that they had lost 1-0, and the manager had to temper the expectations, say, look, we've just narrowly lost to a team who are 30 places ahead of us in the world rankings. A massive, massive difference. We should be very proud of our performance. You know, they were really good in those two games. And so it was very, very surreal and, strange to see them kind of collapse so dramatically against England.
Tim, would you say they they clapped sort of early. I mean, there was that elbow really early on, which could have easily been a red card. Then there was this complete meltdown over a correct VAR decision for the second goal. I mean, I was finding it funny, but at the same time going, I have seen Saturday teams that I play against occasionally meltdown and not be that ridiculous. I mean, it was sort of that embarrassing to me.
Yeah, it really was. It was quite absurd at times, and I think you're right. It didn't look like Cameroon gradually got wound up. You know, that elbow on the key to Paris was in the first couple of minutes. I think it's quite obvious they came out a little bit wound up, and I think Cameroon had six players on a yellow card coming into this game, so they hadn't been adverse to, you know, using fairly physical tactics, which, you know, you'd probably expect from a team at their level coming into this World Cup, coming up against you know, superior opponents. But it was really, really odd. The kind of, particularly, you know, there was crying at one point when they had a goal disallowed, and it just seemed like they really came into the game on an emotional edge.
Wilson, how did you find this?
Yeah, I've never seen anything quite like that. And my reaction was similar to yours. It was just sort of, initially it was great, a bit of shit-housery, and it pretty quickly went into, there's something a bit uncomfortable about this. But yeah, I mean, it should have been a red card, Luko's elbow on Nikita Paris. There should have been a red card at the end for Tacunda's foul on Steph Horton. There should have been a penalty as well. Yeah, and I think what was most bizarre was that the things they got really wound up by were VAR decisions that are line decisions, which just makes no sense. That you know, the second England goal was clearly onside. You know, nobody has any doubt that was onside. Then the goal Cameroon had ruled out, I can understand why you might think, and in fact I think that should not be ruled out. However, we know what the law is. We've seen that in action repeatedly. It's exactly the same as in the Nations League when England had the goal ruled out against the Dutch. It's very tight, but VAR's given it. It's not going to be changed. So then to lose it completely, you assume there must have been something else in the background that had put them on edge before the game. I mean, the only thing that it vaguely reminded me of was the World Cup quarterfinal between England and Argentina in 1966. And, you know, when Argentina sort of threatened to walk off after Ratin had been sent off. And then, you know, subsequent investigation, you find out there's all kinds of problems in the Argentinian camp, and Ratin was suffering badly from homesickness. There was a frustration. The Argentinian delegates had gone to the meeting to decide who should be refereeing it. They'd arrived late, and so the decision had been made by the time they got there, so they felt the whole thing was a stitch-up. In fact, they'd been kicked off the training pitch for a greyhound race to happen the day before. There was a whole series of reasons why Argentina felt the world was against them. I don't know if there's something similar for Cameroon, but you kind of assume there must be.
Well, there is a suggestion made by Phil Neville that because England were sharing the same hotel as or staying in the same hotel as Cameroon, and Phil Neville did say that Cameroon officials had been fighting with each other at the hotel, but he refused to elaborate on that. I don't know. Susie possibly knows more about that, but I think somebody at the press conference after the game yesterday asked Phil Neville to elaborate on Cameroon officials fighting at the hotel and fighting in the VIP area of the stadium, but he wouldn't talk about it.
Susie, can you elaborate on that at all?
Yeah, so in the hotel, it was apparently, according to the FA, there was, who, you know, England and Cameroon, as Phil Neville said, were sharing the same hotel. It was fans and officials of Cameroon fighting with each other over tickets for a game that's not sold out, which is slightly weird. But that was the issue. So it's, you know, fairly innocuous, you know, nothing too kind of controversial that would really kick up things off the pitch. So I don't know if there's more elsewhere going on that would have kind of prompted a reaction of the scale that we saw, but that wasn't really it.
Susie, Phil Neville said, look, there's a bigger picture here. It's the image of women's football going out worldwide. The team mirrored the manager. If I was their manager, they'd never play for me again. What did you make of his comments? And what did you make of the Cameroon manager's comments as well?
The Cameroon manager's comments were really bizarre because he just kept saying, if you watch the game, you will see what I saw. And, you know, basically, you will agree with me. Which, for anyone sitting in that press conference and having watched the game and having sat in the press box and seen the replays of all the incidents, we just could not work out what he was referring to and what they felt so was so unjustified. And he wouldn't be drawn on it. He said, just watch the game, just watch back on the game. We should, you know, rake over old coals, that kind of thing. So that was very surreal. Phil Neville's comments, I think they're very much in the heat at the moment. I'm not necessarily one to say that a game or a team brings an entire nation or women's football into disrepute, because, you know, there's so many incidents in football that don't bring it into disrepute. Generally, I think that's maybe a little bit too far, but like I say, in the heat of the moment, when you're kind of your whole philosophy of the build up to this game has been around you know, what it can do back home and what it represents for women's football, then I can understand why he said what he said in the kind of post match pressers.
And I think another point to make, I completely agree. I think that comment was a little bit on the pearl clutching side, and not everything that happens in a women's football match has to make some enormous macro point about the state of women's football. It's just, it's a football match, some stuff happened, like it does in every other match. But I think another point worth making is that Steph Horton, I use the word challenge advisedly on Steph Horton, happened right at the end of the game and right under Phil Neville's nose. And for me, I think that was possibly the worst incident of the game. The rest of it, I think, just had a bit of an air of farce about it. But that was not okay. And I think we should take Phil Neville's comments as well in that context, that had happened just before he did the interview.
Susie, we talked a fair bit about the quality of the officials. They didn't seem up to it yesterday for me.
I mean, I kind of almost felt sorry for them in that that's a really hard game to referee.
I agree, because, yeah, that's true.
Essentially, the calls were right, and the decisions at the end not to give the red card at the very end, and not to give the penalty for the foul on Fran Kirby, almost felt like she bottled it a little bit, but was, you know, an almost waving of the white flag in an attempt to get the game to the end. You know, the relief. The referee was smiling on the final whistle. He just kind of felt like she was just glad it was over, glad that they had seen out the 90 minutes. So, decision-wise, I don't think she had a terrible, terrible game, bar the early Nikita Paris elbow. Maybe the spitting, although, I mean, it's debatable whether it's intentional or not. I personally think it is when you look at it on replay. But, again, it's hard to say. But in terms of, kind of the various VAR rulings and things like that, that was spot on. So officiating has been hugely questionable across this whole tournament. I don't think she had the worst game that I've seen in this tournament either.
Is it bad of me to have wanted halfway through the second half there to be a sort of really soft handball in the Cameroon penalty area, not give as a penalty, Cameroon go up the other end and score, it's then taken back for a penalty for England that is then saved but ordered to be retaken because the Cameroon keeper stepped off the line, and then England score it just to see what would have happened? Look, Barry, you'll be pleased that we spent this long and we have yet to talk about the actual football. I think probably justifiably so. I didn't think England were that great yesterday.
I don't think they've been particularly great at all. Phil Neville has said he hasn't seen anything from any other team that England should fear, but I don't think any other team will have seen anything from England that'll strike anything resembling terror into their hearts. They seem to have this habit of switching off for like a 15-20 minute period during games, and against better opposition you would imagine they will get punished for doing that. I thought the goalkeeper, Karen Bardsley, didn't have a great game, and I'd be interested to see if she's picked for the next game. But it was a very difficult game for them yesterday, and they got through it relatively unscathed, won comfortably. I don't know if Steph Houghton is going to be ruled out for the next game, and if she is, she'll be a huge loss on the back of that horrific stamp towards the end. But, I think England, they haven't particularly impressed me, but they've got the job done, and that's what it's all about, I suppose, in tournament football. Get through the group stages, get through the, you know, just keep winning.
Keep getting through and then it'll come home, Tim.
Yeah, I'm I'm not sure if Susie will agree with me here. Having watched pretty much every Lionesses game under Phil Neville, this tournament, I think, is entirely in keeping with how we've seen England under Phil Neville. They've been very disjointed. They've been good in parts, bad in parts. And I saw Phil Neville gave an interview before this game where he said something about not compromising on our style. And I kind of read it and I thought, what style? I haven't seen a style. And then a couple of days earlier, he'd given an interview talking about why he rotates the team so much. And he said, oh, we have different players for different styles. So you kind of think, well, which one is it? Are we not compromising on our style, or are we playing lots of different styles? And I just sense there's quite a lot of kind of ad-libbing going on with Phil Neville at the moment, because I don't think he has a real clear idea of how he wants this team to play.
Yeah, it's a weird game to judge the performance on. I agree, generally speaking, that I don't think England have played well in this tournament at all. And some of the defending, particularly in the second half against Cameroon, was almost comical. You know, Norway will have a field day if we're kind of that level again. But at the same time, given the context of that game and how utterly kind of weird it was, it's almost hard to judge how players respond and react in their performance to that situation as well. So again, it's kind of really difficult to necessarily draw much from the performance out on that basis. So I do think they were particularly poor defensively. I mean, one of the biggest criticisms pre this tournament is that they've not been clinical enough up front and they've not been scoring enough goals. The fact that they got three is a improvement. I generally speaking agree with Tim. I don't think Neville necessarily has a very, very clear picture of what he's doing. Now, that said, I think the rotation question is interesting, because what he said he's rotating on the basis of the team he plays and who will best serve the purpose on the pitch for the team that they're playing. Now, Cameroon was completely destined to kettle or fish, because they're a very, very unpredictable side and the team haven't played them since 2012 when Team GB played Cameroon. So it's very hard to kind of set up a team for, you know, a team that is unpredictable. And that was part of the problem, I think. I think he generally went for the most physical team he could to kind of combat their kind of physical presence that they've shown against Canada and the Netherlands and New Zealand. But, it was, again, not the best performance, but they've not really been tested against a team that are real ballers, really.
I think, actually, if that Cameroon goal had been given, England were in trouble. They were rattled there. You know, and I know it was millimetres and it was, you're either offside or you're not, but if that had been given, I think we could have had a whole different ball game.
Do you, on the goalkeeping front, I mean, it's interesting, I didn't really notice Karen Barzi having a bad game, I think because I was just totally taken up with the shithousery that was going on, but by all accounts, Carly Telford is much better at playing it out from the back, Tim, and do you think she should come in? It seems it is always odd for any football team not to have their number one going into a tournament.
Yeah. And actually, Phil Neville has rotated the goalkeepers a little bit as well, on that basis as well. I imagine he went with Karen Bardsley for this. I mean, he usually goes with Karen Bardsley, and I imagine it's because, you know, her build in particular, she's very dominant at coming out for the ball. But yes, I think Carly Telford's probably a better athlete and probably a better footballer with the ball at her feet. But I still expect Karen Bardsley to stay in for the next few games.
Well, Bardsley did make a very important save just after the disallowed goal,
yeah,
after the weak back pass from Greenwood. So, yeah, on that basis, yeah, she is making important saves.
Jill Scott's overtaken Peter Shilton as the player with the most World Cup appearances for England. Susie, is Jill Scott nicer than Peter Shilton? I hope so.
She's hilarious. She's kind of, one of the things she said pre this game is that she likes to hang out with the younger players rather than the older players, purely because she feels like she's more on their mental level, and that, you know, she's just a joker and likes to mess around. So she's a huge amount of fun to kind of be around, to interview in the dressing room. She's generally considered the joker of the team, the one who will lose her passport, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, also an incredibly good footballer. Like, I thought she was like one of the few kind of really excellent players last night. I'd say maybe her and Lucy Bronze and Steph Horton as the three that were particularly good. And yeah, like, really happy that she's got this record, because it's been brilliant for England, brilliant for City, but it's kind of flown under the radar a little bit in terms of kind of players that kind of really get hyped up on an international scale, at least.
What are her views on Brexit? Leave means leave.
Presumably, since you haven't asked, well, that's the next challenge. The next time you see her, just check.
She is from Sunderland. So.
No, I forgot that.
We can keep comparing her and Peter Shilton. Listen, Susie, we'll let you get your train. No doubt we'll speak to you soon. Thanks for coming on.
Nice one. Cheers.
Cheers, Susie. Susie Rack, the Guardian's women's football correspondent. A record-breaking peak of 6.9 million watched England beat Cameroon, up from 6.1 million. Who watched the Scotland game? I keep hearing, Tim, people saying, you know, this is a breakthrough tournament for women's football. I mean, it is, personally, it is for me. It's the first one I've really watched in detail, but that is quite anecdotal. It is just me. I mean, I don't know if you've had a broader view of it. You've watched the game for much longer. Do you feel that?
I think a little bit, but the challenge is always when the World Cup stops and the Premier League starts and the Champions League starts and all of that starts going on again, and women's football is happening alongside that, because we had like a really brief flurry in attendances after the 2015 World Cup. I remember going to Arsenal-Liverpool at Boreham Wood and I had to queue to get in for like the first time in my life. But that kind of gently dropped away quite quickly, and you know, everything gets going again, and that's always the challenge, and there's no easy answer to it. It's sustaining the interest.
If it gets, you know, if it gets to a bigger peak and then drops to a higher, lower level, I mean, I guess that's it,
exactly. So I think, you know, getting the FA have got a target of getting an average of 2,000 at WSL matches, which at the moment it's not. But hopefully this tournament will push it a little bit closer. And the good thing for the WSL as well is, you know, you've got Manchester United coming into it next season, Tottenham coming into it. You know, it's beginning to look a little bit more like the Premier League. So maybe that will draw some bigger crowds as well.
And the games are on Sundays, aren't they, generally?
Largely, yes. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's hard to find a time to put them on that's not competing with a game that's on TV,
exactly.
Right? I mean, it's a similar problem for the EFL games, I guess.
Exactly. It's practically impossible. They experimented for a little while with putting them on Sunday evenings because it was like the only time there isn't
antics,
Premier League
antics roadshow time then, isn't it? Country file and antics roadshow, you know.
But you know, your kind of average makeup of a crowd at a WSL game are families, really, and so 7 p.m. on a Sunday, not the best time for them, so they kind of shelved that.
Alright, England are going to play Norway on Thursday in Le Havre after Norway got past Australia on penalties. I mean, great for Norway because so much has been about Ada Hegerberg not being there. Where will they cause England problems? I mean, I'm nervous.
I think with good cause, actually, because even without Ada Hegerberg, they've got a really, really good forward line. They've got a young striker called Gretton, who's going to Chelsea next season. Really good finisher. But they've got a forward called Caroline Graham Hansen, who is about to go to Barcelona and, for me, is one of the best forwards in the world. And, you know, I don't think England have been convincing at the back, particularly against Cameroon. And I think Norway's front three could cause them real problems.
Australia have had a bad World Cup, haven't they? Why?
They don't have a midfield. This is the thing. So they've got or a defence, really. They've kind of, which are two, you know, quite big problems, really. They've got, you know, obviously they've got Sam Kerr, who's one of the best footballers in the world. But again, they're just another team who don't really seem to have worked out how to play, and they changed their manager quite controversially just before the World Cup. And I just don't think they're quite settled yet.
I wondered if there was more pressure on the Matildas than almost any other team from their home media, because, you know, the Matildas are, they're not perhaps necessarily got at the same level as the Socceroos, but it's much more even in Australia than most other countries.
Yeah, definitely. And they will have come under like a little bit of local pressure. I mean, we saw Sam Kerr's kind of infamous interview after the Brazil game, the sack on that one comment after the game. And that, obviously, they felt like that kind of that focus from local media. And they kind of came into this tournament almost considered as like the famous dark horse bet. And they've got quite a few players who play in the States as well. They're a team of good individuals, which creates a layer of expectation, but I just don't think they're a good team.
France 2, Brazil 1. Barry, I thought this was a brilliant game.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was kind of a bit after the Lord Mayor's show, because I was still sort of mulling over all the shenanigans from the previous game while this was on. But I think it's a game that could have gone either way. that French defender whose name, unfortunately, I can't remember, had, you know, blocked one on the line after
Mbok Batty.
Yeah, after the goalkeeper was beaten. And, yeah, just a good game. I think, was this an upset, Tim, or...?
Well, I thought France were going to win this about 3-0.
Okay.
Brazil are quite an old team. They've got a lot of injuries, and I was expecting France to win this and play much more convincingly than this.
Was Renault a bit lucky not to be sent off?
I thought so.
Yeah.
Early on, she jumped into a challenge, didn't she?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's a bit like VAR will always be a debate, but you sort of think when you go back and watch these challenges, then you think...
Well, I sort of find with VAR, I've now completely lost my capacity to know what's a red card and what's an offside and what's a handball. That I'm now sort of doubting everything.
Mm.
But that, you know, my instinct when I saw that, I mean, I was watching the Argentina game, I switched over for extra time, saw that as highlights. But my instinct when I saw that was, oh, it's a red card. And then, you know, obviously it wasn't a red card. And I was a little bit kind of, yeah. That doesn't seem to be as big a talking point as I thought it probably should have been.
Mm, France had a goal disallowed early on as well, and I saw Ennio Luco tweeting that definitely shouldn't have been disallowed. I once again just couldn't work out what I thought about it. I think you're right. VAR has put everyone into this sort of state of unease. Did you think that was should have been disallowed, or it's quite a dangerous challenge, I guess?
Yeah. I think it should have been disallowed, but I'm happy to bow to Ennio's. You know, well, no, actually, I'm not. I do think it should be disallowed.
You stand by that.
Yeah.
I thought Brazil, Tim, in the second half, I thought it was theirs to win. Actually, I thought Dabinha had a really, really good game. And as Barry says, you know, that goal line clearance was absolutely superb.
Yeah, yeah, and they performed way above expectation. They lost 9 games in a row coming into this tournament. They're in shambolic state. You know, they had players going on strike over the treatment of the former manager and the reinstatement of the current manager. You know, quite an unhappy team, playing really old-fashioned 4-4-2 with strikers who are 33 and 34 years old and therefore not really capable of playing a high-pressing game. And they kind of dropped Marta into midfield for this game, which really, really seemed to help them get a bit of control over the game. I agree. I thought in extra time, I thought they looked the more likely. But France, I think, just have that kind of that capability to get it done. Maybe a bit like England have done so far.
Mm. Well, they were kind of reliant on a dither from Barbara in the Brazil goal. You know, she didn't know whether to stick or twist coming from that cross, and that's what cost them ultimately.
I don't think she could have got there. But I'm happy for you to be confident again if you want. Diani set up the first goal. She's a tremendous footballer, isn't she?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, electric, really. And this is one of France's biggest strengths, kind of particularly coming down the flanks. They've got really good players like Amandine Henry is one of the best players in the world, and she kind of showed that with her goal. But they've just got so much coming down, particularly down the right-hand side. And actually quite a lot of a theme of the tournament is quite a lot of teams I think have got quite weak left backs, and this is an area. Even USA play Crystal Dunn at left back, and that's not really her position.
Well, Maggie's very attacking, she
yeah
really.
Yeah, and she ran
where's
something
10?
Like,
what are you doing, where's yeah, three?
She ran 13k I think in this game overall, which yeah tells you a lot about her performance.
And they've got depth as well. I mean, Delphine Cascarino is a good player. I mean, there is part of me, when I hear Cascarino, I really would love to see Big Tony put on there. Somebody sent me from Delphine Cascarino's Wikipedia personal life. Delphine Cascarino is the twin sister of Estelle Cascarino, also a footballer who played alongside her sister at Olympique Lyonnais before moving to Paris in 2016. They are not related to Tony Cascarino, although they are often asked if they are.
Was there ever a chance of them playing for Ireland?
Possible. A word on Marta, who sort of gave this very emotional press conference at the end. Press conference is always saying she's just interviewed after the game, sort of talking down the barrel of the lens, saying women's football depends on you to survive. Think about it, value it more. We're asking for support. You have to cry at the beginning and smile at the end. It's about wanting more. It's about training more. It's about looking after yourself more. It's about being ready to play 90 and then 30. That's why I'm asking the girls. There's not going to be a Formiga forever. There's not going to be a Marta forever. There's not going to be a Cristiani. I mean, it's a point that they're all quite old, you know?
Yeah. And this is a point that's come up recurringly with Brazil. They were the oldest squad in the tournament, and they've got nothing coming through because it's a typical story. They've been completely neglected by the CBF, their FA. And Formiga gave an interview before the tournament as well, where she was asked about, you know, it being her seventh World Cup. And she said, well, actually, ideally, I'd still be playing club football, but I'd be watching this at home because someone younger would have taken my place. But, there hasn't been someone to take my place because we're not developing younger talent. And it was a remarkable moment, actually, Marta kind of in tears, looking down the barrel of the lens, and a really good, I guess, mic drop moment for her World Cup career, because she did literally just kind of leave the set straight afterwards. And I think I said the last time I was on the pod, she's turned down boot sponsorship deals to wear the symbol of gender equality on her boot. And I think she knows that kind of her career is coming to an end, and she's really, really kind of taking up the cause for women's football and seeing herself as an ambassador in that way.
Is she a future manager, do you reckon?
I'm not sure, but she will stay in football in some capacity, definitely.
Germany 3, Nigeria 0, an Alexandra Popp header, Sandra De Britt's penalty after VAR, and Leah Schuler capitalising on a defensive mistake. Seemed pretty straightforward for Germany.
Well,
do you disagree with that?
No, not at all, but I watched almost the entirety of the post-England-Cameroon press conference on YouTube this morning, the two managers having their say, and a lot of the African journalists seem to think there's this big conspiracy to get them out of the tournament, and this, you know, they used Nigeria's defeat at the hands of Germany and Cameroon's defeat at the hands of England as their examples, and these travesties of justice as they see them. And Phil Neville looked genuinely baffled to be asked about this, you know, and because the better team in both games clearly won. But, yeah, the African journalists do seem to think that there is this conspiracy to get their teams out as quickly as possible.
Oh, but there's been an interesting debate about the criticism of Cameroon, hasn't there, about whether it's sort of taken on a racial element, which seems...
Well, their manager was asked about that. He said, you know, do you think there's a racist conspiracy against your team? And he went, no. He was, you know, straight away, no, I don't. But even the comments section under the match report on the Guardian website, there's a lot of people sticking up for Cameroon, which I found surprising. Because, I mean, I won't lie, I thought it was quite funny, the whole thing, apart from that tackle and the elbow. But their general behaviour and when it looked like they might walk off, I found it massively entertaining. There was a lot of pearl clutching, as Tim referred to it. But, you know, it's the kind of thing in a 6 months or whatever, Phil Neville will probably be laughing about it. We'll all be laughing about it.
We had a question, we sent out on Twitter going, any questions? And someone said, you know, do you think the criticism of Cameroon team would be different if they were A, men and B, white? And I actually thought the fact that we are criticising female footballers is actually quite a good thing, right? We're not trying to sugarcoat it or anything. I thought it was funny until they were sort of abusing Steph Horton when someone's almost broken her ankle. I thought, that is pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't be sensitive either, you know, whether members of the media or just the general public, we shouldn't be sensitive about being challenged about language that's used and things like that. And we should all, you know, take the time to reflect and ask ourselves difficult questions, definitely. But, you know, at the risk of being a white guy sermonising on racial politics, Kiyomo Ubogagu, who's kind of on the fringes of the England squad, used to play for Arsenal. She did a really good thread on Twitter about this, and she was saying, you know, on the other side, we should be careful not to assume that African teams and African players don't have agency over their own actions and that we don't hold them to a lower standard, which could also be seen as a symptom of unconscious bias. So there's quite a lot to unpack here, it's good that the debate's happening and that people are asking themselves these questions.
On the pitch today, Spain, USA and Sweden, Canada. Tuesday, Italy, China, Netherlands, Japan, with my favourite player, Viviana Miedema. She's, I think, the best centre-forward. I think the best centre-forward I've seen there. I think Ellen White finishes very, very well. Obviously, Alex Morgan for the US, but I think Miedema looks just a different order of footballer to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I you know, watch her every game, and you know, her childhood idol was Robin van Persie, and I think that comes across in the way she plays. The interesting thing, talking to her, I've interviewed her quite a lot over the last 2 years, is she does, for someone who scores so many goals, she doesn't really seem to care about goals. It doesn't seem to be her motivator. She used to be a number 10, and I think that gives her a real edge, actually, because she's so calm in front of goal, because it doesn't ruin her day if she doesn't score. And it just gives her this real kind of almost aloofness, which really sets her apart.
All right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll begin with England's the best team at Euro at the, what's it called? Euro 2020, I don't even know what year it is. I'll do that again.
It's 2019.
Right, that... you can keep it in if you want, Tommy. Right, that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two with England's calamitous performance at the under 21 Euros. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. In the break, Jonathan Wilson took some strong painkillers. Are you okay to continue?
Yes, thank you, yes.
Excellent news. Just shows what, you know, they don't make football journalists like they used to.
There's a tramadol, which is now on the banned list for cyclists. I mean, would you fail a drugs test?
I've been taking codeine at night to get me through the night, but I'm just on ibuprofen and paracetamol during the day. But I haven't really been taking them between mealtimes, but I tripped when getting on the tube and it just jerked it slightly. Oh. So
have you been taking your own blood out of your body and then putting it back in after it's been EPO'd? I'm not an expert in this.
I mean, no more than usual.
Okay, excellent. Right, the under 21 championships, after that defeat to France, England followed it up with an excellent defeat to Romania, despite they're still saying they're the best team in the tournament afterwards. Barry, I'm not that concerned about this. I think it might be healthy for England players to have these failures here, get them out of the way, and then when we get to the ones that matter, it will be okay.
Yeah, I don't think the under 21 competition is particularly important. I don't think anyone particularly cares about it. I mean, obviously the players wanted to do well, but I think Chowdhury from Leicester got sent off, and he was describing it as the worst moment of his life, and he'd let everyone down, and it was very much, chill out, it's not the end of the world.
I mean, he did almost kill someone, so
yeah, but I don't think that's why he was upset anyway. But I think there's no harm in them experiencing this failure, but I find it interesting the way they're going about failing, you know, bizarre team selections, the hubris of and this is a word I often misuse, so correct me if I'm wrong, but Eddie Boothroyd leaving Phil Foden, who one presumes isn't tired after a long, wearying season because he didn't play particularly often, leaving him out because he wanted to keep him fresh for the game after Romania, and he will be fresh, and it doesn't matter because England are already out.
Because Eddie Boothroyd could be proved right if Foden has a great game, I think it's tonight against Croatia, because he'll be fresh.
Yeah, but that's just extraordinary, you know, a game you simply have to win. I mean, chances are that we're going to go out anyway because the format of the competition means one group defeat is your card is pretty much marked. But this was a game they simply had to win, and they left out their best player, who wasn't tired, to keep him fresh for the game after. And that's just beggar's belief. And I think Eddie Boothroyd, who's a guy I admire, and he seems like a real nice fella, and I've read interviews Mike Calvin has done with him for various books, and he comes across a very knowledgeable, likeable, erudite man, but he seems, there's a sort of arrogance about the manner in which he's spoken after these defeats that I find slightly odd and at odds with the guy I thought he was, you know, we're still very good. We just happen to lose, and I'm not going to entertain any suggestion that I might be anything other than, you know, or it might be my fault.
You've read excellent interviews with him by Mike Calvin's books. Would you have read excellent interviews with him if they'd been in Jonathan Wilson's books?
It would depend on the subject of the book. Yeah.
Eddie Boothroyd says he's not going anywhere. They'll have to carry me out when asked about his position.
And they may well do.
Well, I really hope they do. Southgate. Dan Ashworth's not there anymore, isn't he? I don't know who will carry the back of it. Graham Kelly and Bert Millerchip will carry Eddie Boothroyd
out. In a sedan chair.
Yeah, exactly. All six goals in the final 18 minutes, which is lots of fun. George Puskas, surely a Championship Manager-generated player name, with the first one. Yanis Hadji, also son of Georgie, also scored. But that, you know, are we that worried about this?
Yes and no. I mean, England's youth teams have not played well at all this year. There's been, you know, serious disappointments, failure to get to the under 20 World Cup to defend it. But, you know, that happens in youth football, right? And it's sort of, I think you have to accept that you know, there's a volatility there that you don't get in senior football because of the nature of what it is. As soon as players start doing well, they get taken away from you. Both games, it wasn't that England were outclassed in both games. They were, I'm not going to say they were the better side necessarily in both games, but they were. It was sort of even until they did something daft let in the first goal. So in that sense, I don't think there is too much to be concerned about. But what is slightly worrying is, you know, as Barry says, the Phil Foden thing. Now, is that Manchester City putting pressure on? I don't know that, but I can't think of any other reason why he would leave him out. He played fewer than 1,200 minutes.
Mm.
So you can't be tired. Ryan Sessegnon, AD Boothroyd was saying, you know, we're worried about his minutes as well. We did play him and then he gets a hamstring injury. But I'm not sure that necessarily follows either.
I mean, Phil Foden's hamstrings are not connected to Ryan Sessegnon's hamstrings, are they?
So I've got a Siamese hamstrings.
Exactly. You can't say, well, look, Sessegnon pulled the hamstrings, so therefore Phil Foden might have, yeah, ruptured his calf.
I mean, if it was Josh and Jacob Murphy,
possible,
so, you know,
yeah,
one twin pulls the hamstring, so the other does too, you know, even if he's not on the pitch.
Or John Toshak and Kevin Keegan, who famously had a telepathic understanding.
Well, it's possible that the DNA has been injected into all these England players, so they are perhaps connected. Or perhaps the DNA is just heroic defeat, in which case this has been a tremendous tournament for the England players to learn what it's going to be like.
Well, I mean, what does slightly concern me is, back in 2011, I was out in Colombia for the Under-20 World Cup, and Brian Eastick, the England coach, had 36 players denied to him that he wanted to call up, but the club just wouldn't release them. And we seem to have got to a situation 2 years ago where the clubs were quite happy to release their players, largely because they weren't actually picking them to play in the Premier League. And we saw a corresponding upsurge in England's former youth football. If pressure is now being applied by clubs not to pick players again, then that is a concern. But more fundamentally, it's obviously disappointing, but I don't think it's too much to worry about.
All right. Don't worry, anybody. Copa America time. Copper America time. I got told off for, you know, sounding like a very posh person.
But you are a very posh person.
Well, you know, there
person.
Is that. Yeah, also a man of the people, Barry. Tim and Wilson, you're watching this forensically. Brazil seem to be the team playing the best at the moment. Would you agree with that, Tim?
Probably. Everyone's been a little bit inconsistent, actually. Everyone, like Uruguay, had a brilliant first game against Ecuador, thumped them 4-0, and then conspired to draw with the Japan B team thanks to a couple of dodgy calls. And, you know, Brazil started okay, had that draw against Venezuela. They were really on it against Peru, to be fair. They made a couple of changes to their attacking lineup. They played Gabriel Jesus on the right-hand side of the attack alongside Firmino. They put Everton on the left as well, and he's really making a big difference to them. But to be honest, nobody looks great at the moment. Colombia got 9 points from their group, but, you know, they haven't exactly been playing electric football throughout. They've just been kind of getting results. So I'm not sure anyone looks
the best.
Yeah, I
mean, that Brazil-Peru game, Brazil were given 2 goals very early on. Two slightly odd, freakish goals, and then they relaxed and played very well second half. Colombia, I think actually they're playing as you'd expect them to play under Queiroz, which is slightly dull possession-based football, and they've got enough going forward to take advantage. Uruguay, I'm just repeating what you said, but I was really impressed by them that first game, and then having thought, oh yeah, they're going to win it for 16th time, they're going to beat Brazil in American art again, and then a pretty poor performance second time round. But I mean, I suppose the big news yesterday was Argentina did go through, although not particularly convincingly against Qatar. They got sort of 3 chances in the first 5 minutes, took one of them, and you sort of thought, oh, that's it. But it really wasn't. Qatar came back into it, they hit the post. Aguero had a terrible first hour or so, then played quite well the last half hour and got the second goal. But, I mean, it's Argentina v Venezuela in the quarter final. And I'm not sure you'd make Argentina favourites for that game.
And Argentina's first goal in the Qatar game,
absolutely presented to them, as Brazil's first couple of goals were presented to them, yeah.
I thought I only saw extended highlights of this game, but I thought Foyth was quite lucky to avoid a red card.
Yeah, got booked quite early on and committed another two fouls. He could have got a second yellow for, absolutely. Which seems to be the way he is, actually. He seems to be a man who just sort of goes around collecting yellow cards.
He got that tremendous red card for Spurs. Now, who was that against?
Bournemouth.
Against Bournemouth. They just had a sending off, and they start the second half, and he'd just been brought on, didn't he? And absolutely went in hip height.
That his debut?
No. He's played quite a few times for Spurs. I like the idea of Japan just putting out their B-side for the Copa America. Just go out there.
Well, it happens, unfortunately, frequently that... The invited teams, because they've got other things to bother themselves about, end up not sending a strong side. I mean, Mexico regularly would send their under 20 side rather than the real side, because they're always preparing for the Gold Cup.
And Japan are preparing for next year's Olympics, effectively, so they're picking an under 23 team to get ready for that.
It's almost like the format of the competition is completely stupid.
Has an invited side ever won?
No, they'd fix it so that didn't happen. Mexico have twice got to the final.
Right.
They lost to Colombia in 2001 and they lost to Argentina in either 91 or 93. 91, I think.
Suspiciously or just outplayed?
I think probably outplayed, but I mean, they would. Yeah, in the Libertadores, Mexico take part because they want the TV revenues, but Mexico never. I mean, it's different now because the final's one leg, but when it was a two-legged final, they would never let the Mexican side play at home second because they never wanted the trophy to be presented in Mexico. We've managed to arrange it so no Mexican side's ever won it.
I really wanted Qatar to win this. Alexis Sanchez scoring goals, though. This is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've never quite bought the idea that he's completely and utterly just fallen off a cliff and become the terrible player we've seen at Man United. I think perhaps there's some other things going on, even if he is probably on the wane. But yeah, for Chile, he looks far more comfortable. The team's built around him a little bit more.
Well, he's had 6 months off.
Yeah, exactly.
He's finally had a break.
Yeah.
I didn't mention this on the pod when I was first alerted to it. The brilliant words of Radamel Falcao talking about Jimenez in the Uruguay defence and talking about just how he put him off. He said, "I couldn't concentrate. Jimenez was driving me crazy. He asked me questions. First, he asked me what car I had. When I was explaining it, he'd already gone and was waiting to meet across. That was only the start. Then he asked me why the flags of Ecuador, Colombia and Venezuela had the same colours. Next, he came over and told me it was his debut, that he was very happy and he'd get a tattoo of the date of his match, asking me if September was spelt with or without a P. I ended up missing the chance to jump for a cross. He drove me crazy."
That's fantastic.
Well, that's next level shithousery. Yeah, being too nice.
Yeah. But the flag question is really good, isn't it? Because that would, whatever you were doing, you'd be like, yeah, I've never really thought about how flags originally
is it something to do with Bolivar? I don't know, I'm guessing. I've got no idea. Is it?
I mean, I don't know.
Are the colours of Bolivar?
I don't know why any flag is the colour it is, I'll be honest.
I've just got this image of Falcao kind of standing on the halfway line, stroking his chin and looking up in the air, going, yeah, why is that?
So what happens now? Group stage is nearly done, and then what are
we got Group C to finish tonight. So we got 8 p.m. We got Chile against Uruguay and Ecuador against Japan. Chile and Uruguay have both gone through already. Is that true? Yes, it is true.
It will be Chile or Uruguay against Peru or Paraguay, and Colombia against one of Chile, Uruguay, and Brazil against Paraguay, Japan or Ecuador.
And yes, Japan and Ecuador.
That's all off the top of my head. By
playing off for the best third place. So if either side wins that, they displace Paraguay's best third place team. If it's a draw, it's on goal difference and Paraguay's is better than Japan's, so Paraguay goes through.
And the kind of, I guess the headline here is there can't be a Brazil-Argentina final now. If they both win their quarterfinals, they'd meet in the semi.
While we're in the Americas, some selected results from the Gold Cup. USA 6, Trinidad and Tobago 0. Canada 7, Cuba 0. Martinique 2, Mexico 3.
Good.
There we are. So I just picked those out. They seem quite interesting to me. We just don't have time to get into the minutiae of the Gold Cup. I apologise.
I don't think I've ever heard of Martinique.
Martinique. It's. I think people go there on the honeymoon, don't they? It's that sort of nice.
That would explain why I've never heard of it.
Is it a British dependency?
Ooh, good question. We've probably got three listeners in Martinique, so if you could get in touch and don't lie like that person did just to get on the pod saying they were in Togo or something, because just tell the truth. It's nice. Right, that all that sort of rambling, nice rambling way to finish part two. We'll start part three with the African Cup of Nations. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly, the African Cup of Nations. Jonathan, you're normally out there by now. You're just going out for the final stages, aren't you?
Like I'll be out for like the quarterfinals.
Like a glory hunter.
Yeah, I'm letting Nick Ames beat the path for me.
Excellent news. And Ed Ahrens is out there as well. He's having fun, isn't he?
Yeah, Ed Ahrens, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, took out the Burundi team's boots.
Right.
Got stopped at customs, who demanded £6,000 off him, and then detained him till 1am, meaning he couldn't get accreditation.
It should add, Ed, a friend of the show, he posted a picture of the packages he was tasked with bringing out for Burundi, and they did look suspiciously like parcels of heroin.
And I
have no idea why he was bringing them out either, but I do, you know, pack these bags yourself, sir.
And Nick Ames took out the Burundi team's kit as well, so I got no idea why they're kit mules. But that does seem to be there.
Occasionally, when I'm just sitting on my sofa watching TV, you know, I quite like, you know, Canada Border Patrol. Is you know, on Egypt Border Patrol, it'd be great to just see it cuts to a dark room and Nick Ames and Ed Ahrens are sitting there going, it was nothing to do with me. On the pitch, Egypt made a winning start, didn't they, Jonathan? 1-0 over Zimbabwe.
They weren't especially impressive, and Zimbabwe were a lot better than I was expecting. So, I mean, I fully expect Egypt to win the tournament. This is the fifth time I've hosted it. They've won three of the previous four. They came third the other time. They've only ever lost twice in competitive Cup of Nations finals games at home. And yeah, the crowds in Egypt are big, and they're noisy, and they're aggressive, and they are hostile. Yeah, it's an intimidatory atmosphere. Last time you saw referees bottling it. You know, the 2006 semi-final, Senegal, Diamante Camara was clearly brought down by Bamsi and didn't get the penalty for it. So, you know, they're very good at taking advantage of home advantage, shall we say.
They haven't lost at home to an African side for 5 years. Fun fact.
Okay, good. they're the most successful team in Cup of Nations history.
Right.
And obviously they've got a really good squad. But they didn't really get going against Zimbabwe.
You say they've got a really good squad. Can you, for those who only know Mo Salah?
Well, I mean, Salah's obviously the star. They've got Trezeguet up front as well, who got the goal against Zimbabwe. They've got Mohamed Elneny in midfield. They've got Hegazi at centre-back, and, you know, in terms of people with Premier League experience. Yeah, they got the final 2 years ago when they hadn't played in the Cup of Nations for 7 years, largely for political reasons, having won the previous three. So, I don't know, they're one of those teams who, although it doesn't quite translate to the World Cup, but certainly in Cups of Nations, they just sort of have a streetwiseness, a canniness, and an ability to get things done. Consistently, I'd say, in the 17 years I've been going to the Cup of Nations, they're always the best defensive side. So, I mean, I saw they were 9-2 before the tournament began, and I was lumping all over that. Like, that's a really good price on Egypt.
That phrase... You saying lumping all over that, I don't know. It's made me feel a bit ill. I don't know why. Uganda won for the first time at the Africa Cup of Nations finals. That's
yeah,
great.
And deservedly so. I mean, it was 2-0.
First time in more than 40 years. Is that the first time ever or the first time in more than 40 years?
No, they got to the final in 1978.
That was the one tournament I wasn't...
But they hadn't qualified until 2 years ago. I spent quite a bit of time with Ugandan journalists in Gabon 2 years ago. They were... very friendly and very sort of helpful. And Uganda actually played quite well without winning a game. And they've seemed to have carried on that development. They won 2-0, both goals from set plays against DR Congo. Who DR Congo, and they lost in the quarterfinal 2 years ago, got the same coach, Florent Ibenge, who I think is very impressive. Every time I've dealt with him, he's been very... you know, he's a very good talker. His teams have consistently played well, but DR Congo completely outplayed by Uganda. Really should have won by more than 2-0. So that group suddenly, I think, looks really interesting because I don't think DR Congo can be that bad again. They play Egypt on Wednesday, and Uganda Zimbabwe, which I'd sort of thought was going to be a battle for third, you suddenly, and that might be a battle for top, might be a battle for second. So yeah, Greek Bay has suddenly become incredibly interesting.
In Private Eye magazine, where Jonathan features on almost fortnightly basis in Sue's Corner, talking about Uganda is a euphemism for having sex.
Is it?
Yeah, when politicians are having an affair.
Ugandan discussions.
Yeah, Ugandan discussions. So trust us to just be actually talking about Ugandan affairs.
In Group B, Nigeria scraped past Burundi. Just 1-0, despite the fact Burundi didn't have kit or boots. Odion Ighalo scored the only goal. And Madagascar in that group as well drew 2-2 with Guinea.
Yeah, and I mean, Madagascar were 2-1 up. And until Naby Keita came on, he was sort of held back for Phil Foden reasons. Although, no, to be fair, he was coming back from the injury, kept him out of the Champions League final, so I think that does make slightly more sense. But until Naby Keita came on, it looked like Madagascar were going to win that. Madagascar were much, much better than I was expecting in their first ever Cup of Nations. And Burundi also in their first ever Cup of Nations, certainly first half, presumably boosted by actually having some boots. yeah, they put Nigeria under a bit of pressure. Now, we know Nigeria were significantly better second half and deserved to win, but it wasn't easy for them.
In Group C, Senegal won 2-0 over Tanzania, and Algeria beat Kenya 2-0. Riyad Mahrez scoring the goal there. Algeria have a chance here or not?
Well, Senegal, I'd say, have a better chance. Okay. I'd have Senegal as my second favourite.
Okay.
They were a bit unlucky 2 years ago.
Was Mane playing on?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they were much better than Tanzania. They could have won that 6 or 7, and Tanzania probably should have about 5 men sent off. There was some very, very generous refereeing in that game. But they've got a lot of pace going forward. With Keita Balde, who got the first goal, and Mane. And I think 2 years ago, the problem was we were a bit over-reliant on pace. So they came in very smart Cameroon side in the quarterfinals, sat very deep against them, frustrated them, beat them on penalties. But they've gone now to... Well, they can play either a 4-3-3 or a 4-4-2. And I think the 4-4-2 allows them to play a sort of more progressive style rather than constantly relying on the pace of those two. So Senegal and Egypt, if they both win their groups, should meet in the semi-final, which will be repeated 2006, and I think that is definitely a game to look forward to.
In Group D, which according to producer Sammy is the group of death, Morocco defeated Namibia 1-0, a last-minute own goal. Ivory Coast play South Africa in that group later. Then Group E and Group F get underway. Before we get on to fun transfer speculation, congratulations to Harold Goulon in the Malaysian FA Cup semi-final, which we're all watching, scored on a free kick from his own half. Do we believe that he meant that? It sort of looks like he went for it.
The way he suddenly sort of has a little, like, you know, his dart up to the ball as if he's kind of, he's noticed the keeper off his line, although he doesn't appear to be off his line. It appears he does go for it. I mean, I can't quite work out how the ball drops as sharply as that. It's almost dropping vertically at the end. So.
And I can't see what else he was trying to do. It really looks really, really deliberate. And you're right, the goalkeeper's not really off his line, so I don't understand what he saw, but he's obviously a footballing visionary.
The only thing I can think of is maybe he knows if he kicks a ball really hard, it'll go precisely 58 yards or whatever that is.
Oh, what, like a golfer? He's like picked out a 7-iron. No,
I remember once playing a game when our keeper had strained his groin or something. I had to take all the goal kicks, and I realised they all dropped almost exactly on the halfway line. I did sort of think to myself, if we get a free kick 46 yards out, just got to do that and it'll drop just under the crossbar. Maybe that's what's just happened there.
Producer Sammy says, very Maynor Figueroa for Wigan against Stoke.
I remember that.
Right, here we go. Fun transfer speculation. Gigi Buffon to Leeds United. This is what we all want, isn't it, Barry?
Oh, absolutely. I did a rumour mill this morning, so I actually wrote some down today so I wouldn't come empty-handed because I can never remember.
Oh, what have you got then?
Well, hang on. Buffon to Leeds is a terrible idea.
Why?
Well, it's a terrible idea because A, he'll cost loads of money.
Yeah.
And B, he can't use his feet. He can't play it from the back. And we saw that at PSG. He struggled to play it from the back.
But I'm not interested in footballing terms. I'm just interested in Gigi Buffon being at Leeds.
Bielsa's sides need a keeper who's at least competent with his feet. So
it would be really off-brand for Leeds to spend loads of money completely unnecessarily on superstars, though.
Exactly. I don't like that.
Okay. Barry, one from your list, then.
There is... apparently Brendan Rodgers has tried to poach Callum McGregor from his former club Celtic, in a, obviously been to further endear himself to Celtic fans, but Celtic have said he's not for sale. Kieran Tierney, their very good fullback, is for sale, however, and apparently Arsenal have had a bid of 15 million rejected. And I suppose it's difficult to know just how good Kieran Tierney is because he's playing in the Scottish League, but when you see figures of 45, 50, 55 million being bandied around for other fullbacks, the 20 million Celtic are supposed to be looking for him seems
cheap.
Yeah, very cheap.
Tim, will he rest? Will he save Arsenal?
I hope so. I mean, Arsenal certainly need a left back, and preferably one who's quite young. I think it would probably make quite a lot of sense for Arsenal. I know, you know, Celtic perhaps don't play in the most competitive environment, but I think one of the really good things Liverpool have done with their transfers is buying players who have at least at some point been at teams who are used to dominating and used to trying to win games and break teams down, and I think that would probably make sense for Arsenal as well, particularly at fullback.
Neymar, Coutinho, swap deal? What do you reckon? Could be good for all parties, apart from whoever gets Neymar?
Yeah, exactly. What, I mean, Neymar's so toxic, just don't touch him.
Okay.
Apparently Messi wants him back, which I don't really understand.
They're in a WhatsApp group together, aren't they? I read that somewhere.
I'm in a WhatsApp group with lots of people I wouldn't want to work with.
Okay. do you want to name names?
No.
Christian Eriksen to Real Madrid has apparently fallen through, so it's Juve or Man United for him now.
Well, there were contrasting reports in different tabloids over the weekend and today. So, according to one, he is going to Real Madrid and Spurs will look for Marco Asensio in return. And according to another, the Eriksen to Real Madrid has fallen through and he will go to Manchester United or Juventus instead.
How much do you think Real Madrid are asking Manchester United for Rafael Varane? According to the nonsense.
Over 100 million.
430 million pounds. Harry Maguire to Man City for 80 million. Would you rather one Rafael Varane or five Harry Maguires?
Five Harry Maguires.
Okay. What would you do with them?
I get them to carry bags around at the minute. Because I'm finding it difficult, and I think he looks like somebody who'd be good at carrying bags.
Hod carrier.
Maybe he could carry Burundi's kit.
Yes.
True.
Yeah. I reckon if you had five Harry Maguires, it'd be very, you know, one of them would almost certainly be a good butcher. You could have a blacksmith.
I would use two as centre-backs, yeah. Controversially.
But Tony Pulis would use four as his defence, and then one at the back of the field.
See, right. It'd be great fun to see when it came on the telly, and it just went... Harry Maguire with his arms folded. Maguire.
There's a Macedonian midfielder apparently could be off to Spurs. He plays for Fenerbahce, who I've never ever heard of. Eljif Elmas. Any learned friends know anything about him?
Yeah.
There's another one who plays for Mainz called Jean-Philippe Bamin. Plays for Ivory Coast. Liverpool, Spurs and Everton want him.
Good.
Come on, Wilson. Larson says, "Hi folks, is Freddie Ljungberg Arsenal's next manager?" Tim, you're the Arsenal man.
I don't know. They've put him into the coaching setup because they want a clearer path for the under 23 players who he worked with last year. And I think that suggests to me they weren't entirely happy with the way Emery did or didn't kind of absorb some young players into the team. If Emery went mid-season, I wouldn't be surprised if he was the caretaker.
Oh, interesting. Paddy says, when's the Aston Villa special coming? 3 years of stuff to catch up on. Have you been doing this 3 years? Question mark. I've been with you since the World Cup. I mean, this pod has been going for longer than that, I'm told.
Which World Cup?
I presume Russia.
I've been doing this since the 2006 World Cup.
He said, I was looking for podcasts to pass the time where I relayed my driveway curbs. I haven't stopped since, either listening or relaying his driveway curbs. We don't know how big Paddy's driveway is. More Villa stuff, please. Okay.
Well, Aston Villa or the Villa that the driveway's leading up to?
Aston Villa, I believe. You've signed Wesley Moraes from Bruges.
Lee Hendry's excited by that.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, you spent 3 hours with Lee Hendry yesterday.
More than 3 hours.
Oh, and how was it?
Svi, nice man.
Yeah, he's a nice man, isn't he? Matt sent us a picture.
He was a ball boy at Aston Villa v Inter under Ron Atkinson.
Oh.
So we spent a lot of time talking about that game and the game 4 years earlier between Villa and Inter under Graham Taylor.
So you didn't think to talk about any of the games he might have actually played in for Villa?
Well, we're building up to that. Didn't quite get there.
See, that's for the next episode. Thank you to Matt, who has sent me a picture of four Manchester United players on mattresses. Lily is the legend of comfort, the global partner of Manchester United. I presume it may be their pillow brand or their mattress brand. I'm not sure. But you've got... in the top, you've got Martial, who sleeps like a corpse. There he is. Martial's basically like a cadaver on the silent witness floor.
Oh, I'm interested now.
Is that Luke Shaw, who is sort of in the fetal position, top right? I think it's Luke Shaw. Juan Mata, who's all over the shop. I mean, his Mrs. Mata will need a separate bed. And Lukaku, taking up quite a small amount of space for quite a large man, and similar to Luke Shaw, but sort of... more neatly laid out. Anyway, that's...
Well, you say that about Lukaku taking up not much room, but I know somebody who was involved in the making of the advert for Lenny Henry.
For Premier Inns.
Right. And apparently the bed he was on was way oversized to make it look bigger than
right?
it actually is.
That's a bit like when I was did my McCoy's.
Or was it the bath? One or the other. I think it was the bed.
Well, that sounds.
I mean, Lukaku's problem has always been his lack of movement.
On the subject of cadavers, actually, Wilson, I have been watching Waking the Dead. Your thoughts?
I haven't seen it. Is it good?
I think you'd like it. I think if you like Silent Witness, you'd be a big fan of Waking the Dead. And there's nine series worth there
really,
to plunder.
Really, because I've only got one Silent Witness I still haven't watched. I haven't been able to track it down yet.
I think you'd like Waking the Dead.
Is Waking the Dead a zombie thing or not?
No, that's The Walking Dead. Oh, right. It's kind of ridiculously similar to Silent Witness, actually.
That sounds great.
Mm.
I just finished Killing Eve series 2. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
Two episodes in, but the complaints that people have made, I haven't seen anything to justify them yet.
I totally agree. I think if they didn't know it wasn't written by Thingamajig, then they wouldn't complain that it wasn't written by
Phoebe
Thingamajig.
Waller.
Bridge.
To finish...
I love that bit in the first episode with the kid on the bed in the hospital where... Yeah. I won't say what happened.
No.
But
why did you love that bit?
Because it was so much in character. It was so kind of...
true.
Because she thinks she's doing the right thing. She actually thinks she's doing a kindness.
Yeah, true. Don't give it away, but she kills another person. Chris says...
Oh, God's sake!
Having never won any bet I've ever placed, and also appreciating this may not make it on the pod due to gambling restrictions, what are Baz and Wilson's thoughts on me having put a whole £1 on Sunderland to win next season's League One title?
It's a quid wasted.
Yeah, probably.
Even if they do, the odds won't be the odds you should get for it.
Mm. There was another question which has disappeared, which was if VAR did exist...
It does exist.
No, sorry. If VAR existed in Boris Johnson's girlfriend's flat, would he still have a chance of being the Prime Minister?
I think Boris Johnson is utterly bulletproof, as far as I can tell. He's Teflon and Kevlar. He's a mixture of both. but, God, this country.
Are you okay, Barry?
Yeah,
I think you do a better job, Prime Minister, and I think you do a really shit job.
I think we've said this before. At least I would have the best interests of the country at heart rather than my own best interests.
Yeah, but you could soon be swayed pretty quickly, couldn't you?
Not really.
Would you keep the smoking ban?
Yeah.
Hmm? What about, who'd be worse, Boris Johnson or those squeaky lads from Kerry?
The squeaky lads from Kerry.
Who are the squeaky lads from Kerry?
The
Healy Rays?
Healy Rays, they're Irish politicians.
Oh, those ones?
Yeah.
Oh, there was a funny video clip of them.
Yeah, they're
wearing this flat cap.
They're awful.
Talking to the big bald fella.
Right, it's probably time to finish, isn't it? Thank you so much for your time, Wilson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Wednesday. Speak to you then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.